Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nyman Show. Today is Monday, February 20th, 2017. There's been quite an information since our last podcast yesterday. I won't give too much detail. Dr. Nyman did it. So, Dr. Nyman, welcome back on such a short notice and giving the people the latest information.
Well, Ryan, it's good to be back, and you know, I thought it'd be a good idea to do an update because the situation in China is changing pretty dramatically, and new information is coming out almost by the hour or so. And I figured if we waited till tomorrow, there'd be another wave of data, which is primarily coming by a release of sequences. And the sequences, you know, as I've always said, stories in the sequence. And there's already a number of kind of somewhat out of sequence, literally and figuratively, stories out there as to what's leading to what and what can be gleaned from the sequences and who's releasing them and when they're releasing them. And I thought it would be good to kind of review that and also provide an update. The situation in China is a little bit murky, and part of the reason it's murky is on the bird side anyway, at a minimum, which kind of spills over into the human side apparently. The China has essentially declared high path avian influenza as being endemic, and therefore instead of having to file immediate notifications and within 24 hours, they can kind of release the information whenever, because they're not really saying that we've got a new high path H5 or H7. They're just saying it's a problem, and we admit it's still an ongoing problem. We haven't, we're not ready to issue an all clear, so to speak. And the problem with that, though, is that there could be new developments, and the rest of the world can get blindsided by these new developments. And in fact, that is what happened. It was known that H7N9 was in China, and there was concern about the number of cases, and there were record numbers of cases for December, record number of cases for January. But it really wasn't clear if these high numbers had anything to do with the genetics of the virus and the behavior of the virus, or whether this was simply a matter of the virus kind of hitting early. And so there was a lot of cases in January, December and January, and the number of cases would decline. And it would be kind of a typical year, except that the peak of the cases was earlier than in prior years. And so the fact that there was a case in Taiwan in and of itself didn't seem to be that unusual, because there had already been a couple of cases exported to Macau, and Macau actually had never had H7N9 before. So that was an indication there was a lot of H7N9 human cases in, or at least, H7N9 poultry, one way or another, people from Macau went to China and came back with the virus. And so that was kind of a clear confirmation of what was already known. And when that happened in Taiwan, it was, again, not that unusual. Taiwan has actually imported cases from China in the past. There were a couple cases in 2013, which was the first year that H7N9 in humans was reported, and there were a couple more the following year. And even though there weren't any in 2014, 2015, there was just this one in 2017 when it was reported. So there had been a few years without virus, but now there was one case. It wasn't that alarming or concerning. And then they released the sequence. And so the sequence came out on Thursday morning. And it's always a little bit of a concern when a country releases a single sequence and is human, and that's what Taiwan did. On the one hand, it wouldn't be that unusual because it was the first case in a couple of years, and it was clearly the first case in 2017 because the name of the sequence was A Taiwan 1 2017. The space between the country's name and the year is what sample number it is, and this is sample number 1. It's clear it was the first case in 2017, but when the sequence came out, Taiwan and China, most of the time, for flu, will release the sequences pretty much just a coding sequence. So the size of the sequence pretty much tells you something about the protein. And typically, for H7, the size of the protein and nucleotides is 183. And this sequence was 1,695, so it was 12 nucleotides larger. And sometimes the sequences that are released, the nucleotide sequence actually is a little bit bigger than the coding sequence. Because where the primers are, they can have a little bit of the sequence before the coding or after the coding. And when I looked at the sequence, it didn't have additional nucleotides before or after it. It started with a start codon with an ATT, and it ended with a stop codon with an AAT or a TAA. And so it indicated that there were 12 extra nucleotides in that sequence. And when I took a look at the protein sequence, I thought that those 12 nucleotides would encode four additional amino acids, and those four additional amino acids were at the cleavage site, and three out of the four were actually basic amino acids. So he created a polybasic cleavage site. The polybasic cleavage site is indicative of high pass, and just as a reminder, prior to Saturday, every H7N9 sequence out of China had been low pass. It had a fairly benign cleavage site that would keep the virus pretty much in the respiratory tract. And as far as birds were concerned, including the experimental chickens, the birds really didn't get very sick. If they got sick at all, might reduce egg production. That's a plus and a minus. The plus is the birds stay alive, they can recover. The minus is the virus can spread silently. And unfortunately, even though it's low path in birds, it's high path or it's lethal in humans with a fatality rate in the ballpark of 30-40% of the people that get affected with the H7N9 end up dying. So it's not a good situation for humans. It doesn't make that much difference to birds, and it can actually be a positive. They can gain some immunity by being infected with the low-pass H7N9. They simply recover. It's a temporary situation where they don't feel well. It's kind of like humans getting the flu. Most people get the flu and are sick for a few days, maybe a few weeks, depending upon the strain and other conditions. But they recover, and they have some immunity, and it's not a life or death situation, whereas in humans with H7N9, it in fact is. And H7N9 has been a concern because not only can it lead to death in relatively young people, the H7N9 in humans in China has a couple of the hallmarks of human-to-human transmission, mammalian adaptation. One of them, there's two positions in the H that raises a lot of concerns, the position 226 and 228. And the virus in the human cases in China, most of them actually have the change that adapts them to mammals. The Q at position 226 is changed to L. And similarly, another adaptation is with a polymerase gene, and that's at position 627, and that affects how quickly the the polymerase copies the genetic information at various temperatures, and if there's an E at position 67, its optimal rate is at 41 degrees, which is the body temperature of a bird, and if it's got a K, the optimal activity is really at 33 degrees centigrade, and that's a lot closer to the human body temperature, which is 37 degrees, and in fact, human nose in the winter will be actually fairly close to 33 degrees from the cold air going into the nose. It'll kind of reduce the temperature in there, and that will lead to the polymerase gene, you know, picking up activity and be able to copy the genetic material quicker, and the quicker it copies it, especially if that's a rate-limiting step, then you get more virus. If you get more virus, you have a higher viral load, and it's likely to be both more severe for the host and more transmissible to contacts of the host. So there's a significant selective advantage for the H7N9 to have E67K, or there's a few analogous changes at 701 and D701N, kind of do the same thing. They have those mammalian adaptations, then there's a higher likelihood that a human infected with that virus would actually die or have more severe illness because the virus is just able to grow quicker. So when the sequence came out, it actually did have the E67K, and it didn't have the change of position 226, but it did have the high path cleaver site. And so that was a concern because it's never been reported previously. And in chickens, the reason it's more produces a higher fatality rate is because that cleaver site, you know, has to be cleaved by an enzyme coded for by the cell it's trying to get into. And there's a bunch of basic amino acids in these endonucleases, the enzymes that cleave the protein do it. Next to a basic amino acid, if there's a number of basic amino acids, then more different types of enzymes and different cell types can actually do that cleavage process, and therefore it can expand the number of cells that the virus should actually get into, and that can lead to viral infections and organ failure, as well as just all kind of problems from having too much virus and then having too much of a new response to that virus. And so it's just not a good thing to have, particularly in the birds, but, it's probably not a good thing in humans either. The fact that this was showing up in the case was one concern. The other concern was that the first example of this was in a businessman in Taiwan who visited Guangdong Province. So they kind of suggested that he got infected in Guangdong Province. And the fact that Taiwan reported the case and Guangdong Province hasn't reported this high path, H7N9, in any humans or any poultry raised concerns that either A, they didn't have very good surveillance, or B, they didn't have a need to actually make an announcement on what they had, even though, like I said, this would be the first time that high path had ever been reported. And so I ended up doing a podcast on rents on Thursday night because I'm on for the third Thursday of each month, and this actually was the third Thursday of the month of February. And so I did one update. It was going to be on H5N8, just over H7N9, and that's available at recombinomics.co. Dr. Nyman's corner, that thread, has a link to the MP3, so you can hear the initial report. And then we did another report yesterday, and it's also at recombinomics.co, and that was updated because on Saturday there was a second H7N9 sequence, and this one actually did come from Guangdong Province, and it was done by the Guangdong CDC, and it had the same 1695 as far as the size was concerned, and it had the same polybasic cleavicide, and it was a little concerning because even though it had the same cleavicide was high path, there was a different constellation, so it indicated that, you know, there was, it wasn't that you had one and then that clonally expanded and it kind of spread out from that one location. This indicated that it was kind of spreading from at least two different locations. And as the CDC you know, gave some information on the case, it was in Qingyuan. It was from a 56-year-old male, and it was stable. And then the report out of Taiwan indicated that that individual was a 69-year-old male, and he had traveled for Yangxiang. And although both of these were in Guangdong province, they really weren't very close to each other. And as I said, the sequences had two different constellations. So that raised concerns that the virus was potentially fairly widespread and was doing, you know, significantly high rate of reassortment, where you got the same kind of H, but some of the internal genes had were obviously different. And so that again kind of raised questions as to what did China know and when did they know it, if you will, that we got two human cases and they both have this high path, H7N9. There's a reasonably strong chance that it's in poultry, and if it's got the high path cleavicide, it's not only in poultry, but it's killing poultry. And that makes it a lot easier to detect. So it would seem that there would be poultry that was dying that did test positive for H7 that led to sequence analysis and led to the conclusion that the poultry was dying because they had high path H7N9. This has never been reported before, but even though that would be a major piece of news, there was no information. I mean, when I did the podcast yesterday, there was still no reporting. Actually, the reporting had just started yesterday. I take that back. So when the sequence came out, there had been no reports. But then yesterday, there were some media reports that kind of suggested that there were two cases in the mainland, China. And they were described as one case who had already recovered and the other case that was in the hospital. And so those two cases really sounded different than the two cases that were represented by the two sequences. So it sounded like there were already now four cases. And they also indicated that there were four poultry samples that were also high path. And they were Guangdong province. They didn't really say what the species was and where they were. But that did suggest that China was aware of this high path being there, and it wasn't limited to the two human cases represented by the two sets of sequences, and it really was in poultry. So that came out yesterday, and then today, reports started talking about Tammy flu resistance, and H7N9 is known to occasionally have changes at position 292, where the R changes to the K, that leads to Tamiflu resistance. And WHO had just issued an update on H7N9 in China, and they had indicated that they had looked at 81 sequences, and two of those 81s did have that Tamiflu resistance. And so Tamiflu resistance, of course, is a concern because Tamiflu is used pretty actively. And actually, I think it's Rilenza resistance also. So Tamiflu and or Rilenza is used for a lot of the cases in China because they know that H7N9 can be fatal. And therefore, they'll start antiviral treatment, you know, fairly early on in the clinical course. And it was kind of a concern, but not a major concern because, 79 out of 81 did not have this change, and they were Tamiflu sensitive. When that was mentioned, I went back and looked at the two sequences that had already been published, and they both had our P92K, and so they both were indeed Tamiflu resistance. And that raised another big red flag because, as I mentioned, there were two different locations. They had two different constellations. But in spite of that, they both were high path, and they both had the Tamiflu resistance marker. So as far as the high path was concerned in human cases, instead of being 2 out of 81, which had been reported by WHO for the high path, it was actually 2 out of 2. And that raised concern that not only was the high path polybasic cleavage becoming widespread, but that Tamiflu resistance was also becoming widespread. And then this morning, after I kind of looked at those two sequences for Tamiflu resistance, I noticed that there were new H7N9 sequences. And there, in fact, were three new H7N9 sequences that were at TSAD. Two of them were from humans, and one was from an environmental sample. Environmental samples usually are associated with birds, and they either are derived from a fecal sample, or if they're in cages, they might have found them in their stalls or cages or wherever. They collected a swab and tested for the virus and had enough virus to be able to either sequence or grow and sequence it. And they don't really tell you what species it came from. It's called environmental for the species, but it, you do get the sequence. And then I took a look at these two sequences and realized that one of them was at the end of 2016 and was probably the case that had been discharged, and the other was at early 2017. It actually had been collected on January 7th, and that was probably the case that was still in the hospital. And WHO characterizations didn't give any more information. It gives the age and the gender, and they were in Guangdong Province. So they didn't say where they were in Guangdong Province. But CHP in Hong Kong has been compiling a list of cases, for most of the cases, they include the age, the gender, and the location. That usually goes down to the city. So you can localize it on the map, and I've been mapping these sequences, and then they kind of give you the condition of the patient at collection. And there really haven't been all that many Guangdong province sequences that have been released. So we kind of went through the list of the sequences to see if there was any 47-year-old females, and in fact there was one, and she was from Zhaoqing in Guangdong province. So I was able to with high confidence that was the location of the third case, and it was really that close to the other two. So it kind of indicated this high path H7N9 was had three cases that were linked to three different towns in Guangdong province. If you look on the map, you'll see that these towns really aren't all that close to each other, and the sequences weren't that close to each other either. So that indicated that the virus was very widespread. And then we looked up the 56M, the male that was 56. We did find a match, and it was also in Qingyang province. I'm sorry, Guangdong Province, but Qingyuan City in Guangdong. And that was the same location as the fatal case that was described. The sequence was released by Guangdong CDC. And so we kind of compared the two sequences, and the two sequences were virtually identical. So, and some of the G segments actually were identical, and others there was a one nucleotide difference, and one of the genes, I think there was a two nucleotide difference. And most of these gene segments were dramatically different than anything else in the database. So it's virtually positive that the two sequences that were from a 56-year-old male were actually from the same 56-year-old male. And that when it was collected January 7th, that case was alive, and that's what the release from WHO indicated. But when the sample was collected a week later, that patient was dead. And so WHO's saying the patient is in the hospital, when in fact by January 14th, the patient was dead. And it's, so the patient died over a month ago. And WHO is not telling you that patient's dead. It's telling you that patient is hospitalized. But, so there's a little bit of a lag in the information they released when they finally do release it. And the difference is that in one they say the patient's in the hospital, they make it sound like it's not so bad to have this high path. But when Guangdong probably collected, when he died, he collected samples at death. They put on the characterization sheet the patient was dead. And the sequence was virtually identical to what it was when the patient was alive. And it's virtually certain that it's the same patient. So in any event, even though there's four sequences in T-SAN, it looks like there's really two different patients, two sequences from the same one. That one sequence was collected on January 7th when the patient was alive. The other sequence was from January 14th when the patient was dead. And of interest, all four of these sequences, which are probably from three people, all had Tamiflu resistance. So now it wasn't two out of two sequences. It was four out of four, or, in all likelihood, it's three out of three patients. And they all had Tamiflu resistance with this high path sequence. So that was, a bad indication that this Tamiflu resistance may, in fact, be very widespread. Then the other piece of information was the E627K. The E627K was present in the patient who died, and it was present actually before the patient died. It was in the first collection of the patient who was going to die. And it was also present in the patient from Taiwan who initially had mild symptoms and tested negative, but then he subsequently tested positive, and he's currently in critical condition. And so three sequences had E627K, and all likelihood from two patients, one who was fatally infected, the other is in critical condition. And the patient that recovered actually did not have E627K. So that's an indication that if that version doesn't appear, the virus isn't going to replicate that well in the human because it's optimized for 41 degrees. And so the patient did develop a high fever, then the virus was at a disadvantage as far as how quickly it could copy it, right? The genetic information in a human versus how quickly it could do it in a bird, and the patient ended up recovering. So, the outcomes is very, has a pretty good correlation with the viral load, and the viral load is, somewhat dependent upon how fast that virus can make new copies of itself. And so these markers kind of correlated fairly well with the outcome. Sample size, of course, is pretty low, but it turned out if they got E67K, it's a bad an indicator of a poor prognosis. And then it indicates that, if you don't have E67K, in the case of the 47-year-old female, she did recover, even though she did have Tamiflu resistance, which indicates that you can recover even if there is that type of problem, but that problem could accentuate the situation in a negative way, and therefore the critical and the fatal case is were high pathogenic, B, they had E67K, and C, they were chemically resistant. Now, I'll note the full sequence from the bird. The good news was it didn't have Tamiflu resistance. It didn't have E67K, which it would be unusual if it did because it was from a, well, they didn't say it was from a bird, but it was from an environmental sample, which is in all likelihood a bird. But the bad news was that the collection date was on November 7th. So that indicated that this high path avian influenza has been in China for some time. And in all likelihood, China's known about it for some time because the indications from the media reports are that the birds infected with the high path virus die. And so they would have birds that are dying that were A7 positive, which would invariably lead, at least at the beginning, to some sequence to find out, why are they dying if they've got low path A7. And they would find out they're dying because they have high path A7. So in all likelihood, the WHO regional center in Beijing, China, is known that they have high path A7 and 9 for some time now. Unless these samples just sat in the freezer and they decided not to sequence them, even though they came from a dead bird, which I would put in an extremely unlikely category, and didn't say a word about it until Taiwan released their sequence, and their sequence says there's a problem. And that's the last thing a country wants to happen, is that a disease that they know about and don't say anything about gets uncovered by a country who sent one of their citizens to visit, in this case probably on business, and they came back with the virus. And nobody said that that virus was there. So it kind of doesn't say anything about high path A7 and 9, and the world finds out about it when the CDC in Taiwan releases the sequence. So, exporting novel viruses that are unreported is not supposed to happen. And that's part of the reason, they have this surveillance and part of the reason they have these requirements. And apparently, China thought that the fact that they had high path A7 and 9, which has never been reported before, wasn't novel enough to report until somebody else reported it, and then they thought it was novel enough and important enough to say, well, it wasn't that we didn't know about it. Here are the sequences, and we got, turns out they have 7 sequences, because after I saw that one that had a full sequence, I looked a little more closely, and they had 6 additional sequences that they'd only released the H7 and the N9, but they didn't call them H7 and N9. They actually didn't say what the serotype was, so the search for H7 and N9 did not return those 6 sequences, but when you did a blast with the H7, it was very obvious that A, they were all closely related, and B, the size of the H7 was 1695, indicating they had the additional 12 nucleotides or the 4 amino acids, and they were the same basic amino acids that were present in the high path. So they had 6 that were high path. They didn't say where they were other than they were Guangdong province, and they didn't release the internal genes, but they did admit that the samples not only contained H7 and 9, but they had H9 and 2. And so that was another indication of what a mess things are in China, and that they have all of these H7 and 9 birds that are infected with H9 and 2 at the same time, so they can pick up both sequences from the same sample. And it really helps explain why all of these viruses have different constellations, because there's not only bird flu all over China, but it's at such a high level that a lot of these animals have at least 2 distinct serotypes in the sample at the same time, indicating that they're not going to get out of this high-path avian influenza situation anytime soon, and also an indication that they really don't have very good control over the situation, which is somewhat alarming due to the fact that they now have H7N9 high-path Tamiflu resistant, which seems to be widespread, at least in Guangdong, but maybe much more widespread because there's at least one report that a woman in Shandong province, which is in northern China, has H7N9, and she's got about 100 chickens, and four or five of them have died, raising the distinct possibility that high-path H7N9 is circulating in northern China anyway. So, in any event, I wanted to get this podcast out because there had been all of these developments. There indeed is Tamiflu resistance, all four sequences, likely from three different patients in Guangdong province have the Tamiflu resistance. The two more serious ones also have E67K. All of these, by definition, have this high polybasic cleavage site. So they've all got the identical polybasic cleavage site. And that cleavage site is on seven different chickens somewhere in Guangdong province. And these were collected actually between November 7th through December 12th. So they didn't all come from one location. They didn't come from one time. They indicate this virus has been in Guangdong province since at least early November and has persisted and is present in collections in November, multiple collections in November, multiple collections in December. How closely related are geographically these are to each other really isn't known. All they say is Guangdong. They don't say where in Guangdong. But the one full sequence is not a match for any of the three human sequences. So they all, the full sequences, the three human full sequences and the one environmental full sequence, none of them match each other. They all match in the sense they're high pass. All of the humans match in the sense that they're Tamiflu resistant. But if you compare each of the 18 segments, none of the four full sequences match each other. I mean, the only two that match each other are the two from the from the 56-year-old male, and almost certainly are both from the same patient. So the only set of sequences that match are the fatal case done by the Guangdong CDC, as well as the in-hospital, if you will, patient that was cited by Beijing, WHO in Beijing. So in all likelihood, there are three people, there are four sequences, and they all have Tamiflu resistance, and the more serious ones have these 67K, they're all high path. And it's likely that this high path is very widespread, at least in Guangdong province. And maybe on the rise, and I'm sure there'll be more information on this version in the near future.
Okay, well, thank you for the information. Listeners can always visit economics.co. That's where all the latest information is posted all the time, and we will definitely do more podcasts as the situation unfolds. And as Dr. Diamond mentioned, the situation is evolving very rapidly, and there probably will be a lot more information in the coming days.